and sometimes a large plateau rising with sheer sides. Things grew, but nothing lush. Tough, short grass. Bushes wiry and covered with thorn, and other things that even seemed to have thorns on their fat leaves. Scattered, stunted trees twisted by the wind. Yet wolves could find hunting even in this land. As he peered at this rough land, a circle of darkness suddenly blanked out a part of the mountains. He could not have said whether the darkness was right in front of his face or halfway to the mountains, but he seemed to be seeing through it and beyond. Matt rattling a dice cup. His opponent stared at Matt with eyes of fire. Matt did not seem to see the man, but Perrin knew him.
"Matt," he shouted, "it's Baalzamon! Light, Matt, you're dicing with Baalzamon!"
Matt made his toss, and as the dice spun, the vision faded and the dark place was dry mountains again.
"Hopper!"
Perrin turned slowly, looking in every direction. He even looked up in the sky. He can fly now. Where clouds promised to rain, the ground far below the spire top would drink up as soon as it fell.
"Hopper!"
A darkness formed among the clouds, a hole into somewhere else. Egwene and Nynaeve and Elaine stood looking at a huge metal cage with a raised door held on a heavy spring. They stepped in and reached up together to loose the catch. The barred door snapped down behind them. A woman with her hair all in braids laughed at them, and another woman, all in white, laughed at her. The hole in the sky closed, and there were only clouds.
"Hopper, where are you?"
he called.
"I need you, Hopper!"
And the grizzled wolf was there, alighting on the spire top as if he had leaped from somewhere higher.
"Dangerous. You have been warned, young bull. Too young. Too new yet."
"I need to know, Hopper. You said there were things I must see. I need to see more. Know more."
He hesitated, thinking of Matt, of Egwene, and Nynaeve and Elaine.
"The strange things I see here, are they real?"
Hopper's sending seemed slow, as if it were so simple the wolf could not understand the need to explain it or how to. Finally, though, something came.
"What is real is not real. What is not real is real. Flesh is a dream, and dreams have flesh."
"That doesn't tell me anything, Hopper. I do not understand."
The wolf looked at him as if he had said he did not understand that water was wet.
"You said I had to see something, and you showed me Baalzamon and Lanfear."
"Heartfang, Moon Hunter."
"Why did you show me, Hopper? Why did I have to see them?"
"The last hunt comes."
Sadness filled the sending and a sense of inevitability.
"What will be, must be."
"I do not understand. The last hunt? What last hunt? Hopper, gray men came to kill me tonight."
"The not dead hunt you?"
"Yes, gray men. After me. A dark hound was right outside the inn. I want to know why they're after me."
"Shadow brothers."
Hopper crouched, looking to either side as if he almost expected an attack.
"Long since we have seen the Shadow Brothers. You must go, young bull. Great danger. Flee the Shadow Brothers."
"Why are they after me, Hopper? You do know. I know you do."
"Flee, young bull."
Hopper leaped, forepaws hitting Perrin's chest, knocking him back over the edge.
"Flee the Shadow Brothers."
The wind rushed in his ears as he fell. Hopper and the edge of the spire top dwindled above him.
"Why, Hopper?"
he shouted.
"I have to know why."
"The last hunt comes."
He was going to hit. He knew it. The ground below rushed up at him, and he tensed against the crushing impact that... He started awake, staring at the candle flickering on the small table beside the bed. Lightning flashes lit the window, and thunder rattled it.
"What did he mean, the last hunt?"
he mumbled.
"I did not light any candle." You talk to yourself and thrash in your sleep.
He jumped and cursed himself for not having noticed the herbal scent in the air.
Zareen sat on a stool at the edge of the candlelight, elbow on her knee, chin on her fist, watching him.
You are Tavirin, she said, as if ticking off a point. Stoneface thinks those odd eyes of yours can see things his can't. Gray men want to kill you. You travel with an Aes Sedai, a warder, and an Ogier. You free caged Aiel and kill White Cloaks. Who are you, farm boy? The dragon reborn?
Her voice said that was the most ridiculous thing she could think of, but he still stiffened uneasily.
Whoever you are, big man, she added, you could do with a little more hair on your chest.
He twisted around, cursing, and scrabbled one of the blankets over him to his neck.
Light. She keeps making me jump like a frog on a hot rock.
Zareen's face was at the edge of shadows. He could not see her clearly except when lightning shone through the window, the harsh illumination casting its own shadows across her strong nose and high cheekbones. Suddenly, he remembered Min saying he should run from a beautiful woman. Once he had recognized Lanfear in that wolf dream, he had thought Min must mean her. He did not think it was possible for a woman to be any more beautiful than Lanfear. But she was just in a dream. Zareen was sitting there staring at him with those dark, tilted eyes, considering, weighing.
What are you doing here? He demanded. What do you want? Who are you?
She threw back her head and laughed. I am Fael, farm boy, a hunter of the horn. Who do you think I am, the woman of your dreams? Why did you jump that way? You would think I had goosed you.
Before he could find words, the door crashed back against the wall and Moraine stood in the doorway, her face as pale and grim as death. Your wolf dreams tell as truly as a dreamer's, Perrin. The Forsaken are loose, and one of them rules in Ilion.
Chapter 44. Hunted.
Perrin climbed off the bed and started dressing, not caring whether Zareen was watching or not. He knew what he intended to do, but he asked Moraine anyway.
Do we leave? Unless you want to make closer acquaintance with Samael, she said dryly.
Thunder crashed overhead as if to punctuate her sentence, and lightning flashed. The Aes Sedai barely glanced at Zareen. Stuffing his shirt tail into his breeches, he suddenly wished he had his coat and cloak on. Naming which one of the Forsaken it was made the room seem cold.
Balsamon isn't bad enough. We have to have the Forsaken loose, too. Light. Does it even matter if we find Rand now? Is it too late?
But he kept dressing, stamping his feet into his boots. It was that or give up, and Two Rivers folk were not known for giving up.
Samael? Zareen said faintly. One of the Forsaken rules... Light!
Do you still wish to follow? Moraine said softly. I would not make you stay here, not now. But I will give you one last chance to swear to go another way than I.
Zareen hesitated, and Perrin paused with his coat half on. Surely no one would choose to go with people who incurred the wrath of one of the Forsaken. Not now that she knew something of what they faced.
Not unless she has a very good reason.
For that matter, anyone who heard one of the Forsaken was loose should already be running for a sea folk ship and asking passage to the other side of the Aiel Waste, not sitting there thinking.
No,
Zareen said finally, and he began to relax.
No, I will not swear to go another way, whether you lead me to the Horn of Valir or not. Not even whoever does find the horn will have a story such as this. I think this story will be told for the ages, Aes Sedai, and I will be part of it.
No, Perrin snapped. That is not good enough. What do you want?
I have no time for this bickering, Moraine broke in. Any moment, Lord Brand may learn that one of his dark hounds is dead.
You can be sure he will know that means a warder, and he will come looking for the Gaidin's Aes Sedai.
Do you mean to sit here until he discovers where you are?
Move, you foolish children! Move!
She vanished down the hall before he could open his mouth. Zareen did not wait either, running from the room without her candle.
Perrin hastily gathered his things and dashed for the back stairs, still buckling his axe belt around his waist. He caught up to Loyal going down, the Ogier trying to stuff a wood-bound book into his saddlebags and put on his cloak at the same time. Perrin gave him a hand with the cloak while they both ran down the stairs, and Zareen caught the pair of them before they could dash out into the pouring rain. Perrin hunched his shoulders against the wet and ran for the stable across the storm-darkened yard without waiting to pull up the hood of his cloak.
She has to have a reason. Being in a bloody story isn't reason enough for any but a madwoman.
The rain soaked his shaggy curls, laying them flat around his head, before he darted through the stable door. Moraine was there before them, in an oiled cloak, still beaded with rain, and Nita holding a lantern for Lan to finish saddling the horses. There was an extra, a big gelding with an even stronger nose than Zareen's.
"I will send pigeons every day," the stout woman was saying. "No one will suspect me. Fortune prick me. Even white cloaks do speak well of me." "Listen to me, woman," Moraine snapped. "This is not a white cloak or a dark friend I speak of. You will flee this city and make anyone you care for flee with you. For a dozen years you have obeyed me. Obey me now."
Nita nodded, but reluctantly, and Moraine growled with exasperation.
"The bay is yours, girl," Lan said to Zareen. "Get on his back. If you do not know how to ride, you must learn by doing or take my offer."
Putting one hand on the high pommel, she vaulted easily into the saddle.
"I was on a horse once, Stoneface, now that I think of it."
She twisted around to tie her bundle behind her.
"What did you mean, Moraine?"
Perrin demanded as he tossed his saddlebag across Stepper's back.
"You said he would find out where I am." "He knows. The Gray Men."
Nita giggled, and he wondered irritably how much she really knew or believed among the things she said she did not believe in.
"Samael did not send the Gray Men."
Moraine mounted Aldeeb with a cool, straight-backed precision, almost as if there were no hurry.
"The Dark Hound was his, however. I believe it followed my trail. He would not have sent both. Someone wants you, but I do not think Samael even knows you exist. Yet."
Perrin stopped with one foot in the stirrup, staring at her, but she seemed more concerned with patting her mare's arching neck than with the questions on his face.
"As well I went after you," Lance said, and the Aes Sedai sniffed loudly.
"I could wish you were a woman, Gaidine. I would send you to the tower as a novice to learn to obey."
He raised an eyebrow and touched the hilt of his sword, then swung into his saddle, and she sighed.
"Perhaps it is as well you are disobedient. Sometimes it is well. Besides, I do not think Shiriam and Swan Sanche together could teach you obedience."
"I do not understand," Perrin said.
"I seem to be saying that a great deal, and I'm tired of it. I want some answers I can understand."
He pulled himself the rest of the way up, so Moraine would not be looking down at him. She had enough advantage without that.
"If he did not send the Gray Men, who did? If a Murdral or another Forsaken..."
He stopped to swallow.
"Another Forsaken? Light. If somebody else sent them, why did they not tell him? They're all dark friends, aren't they? And why me, Moraine? Why me? Rand is the bloody dragon reborn."
He heard the gasps from Zareen and Nita, and only then realized what he had said. Moraine's stare seemed to skin him like the sharpest steel.
"Hasty bloody tongue. When did I stop thinking before I speak?"
It seemed to him it had happened when he first felt Zareen's eyes watching him. She was watching him now with her mouth hanging open.
"You are sealed to us now," Moraine told the bold-faced woman. "There is no turning back for you. Ever."
Zareen looked as if she wanted to say something and was afraid to, but the Aes Sedai had already turned her attention elsewhere.
"Nita, flee Ilion tonight, in this hour, and hold your tongue even better than you have held it all these years. There are those who would cut it out for what you could say before I could even find you."
Her hard tone left doubts as to exactly how she meant that, and Nita nodded vigorously, as if she had heard it both ways.
"As for you, Perrin."
The white mare moved closer, and he leaned back from the Aes Sedai despite all he could do.
"There are many threads woven in the pattern, and some are as black as the shadow itself. Take care one of them does not strangle you."
Her heels touched Aldib's flanks, and the mare darted into the rain, Mondarb following close behind.
"Burn you, Moraine,"
Perrin thought as he rode after them.
"Sometimes I do not know which side you are on."
He glanced at Zareen, riding beside him as if she had been born in a saddle.
"And whose side are you on?"
Rain kept people off the streets and canals, so no visible eyes watched them go. But it made the footing uncertain for the horses on the uneven paving stones. By the time they reached the Moreto Causeway, a wide road of packed dirt stretching north through the marsh, the downpour had begun to slacken. Thunder still boomed, but the lightning flashed far behind them, perhaps out to sea. Perrin felt a bit of luck was coming their way. The rain had stayed long enough to hide their departure, but now it seemed they would have a clear night for riding. He said as much, but Lan shook his head.
"Dark hounds like clear, moonlit nights best, blacksmith. Rain the least. A good thunderstorm can keep them away completely." As if his words had bidden it, the rain faded to a faint drizzle. Perrin heard Loyal groan behind him.
Causeway and marsh ended together, some 2 miles or so from the city, but the road kept on, slowly bearing a little eastward. Cloud-dark evening faded into night, and the misting rain continued. Moraine and Lan kept a steady, ground-eating pace. The horses' hooves splashed through puddles on the hard-packed dirt. The moon shone through gaps in the clouds. Low hills began to rise around them, and trees to appear more and more often. Perrin thought there must be forest ahead, but he was not sure how he liked the idea. Woods could hide them from pursuit. Woods could let the pursuit come close before they saw. A thin howl rose far behind them. For a moment, he thought it was a wolf. He surprised himself by nearly reaching out to the wolf before he could stop. The cry came again, and he knew it was no wolf. Others answered it, all miles behind. Eerie wails holding blood and death, cries that spoke of nightmares. To his surprise, Lan and Moraine slowed, the Aes Sedai studying the hills around them in the night.
"They are a long way," he said. "They'll not catch us if we keep on."
"The Dark Hounds?" Zareen muttered. "Those are the Dark Hounds?
Are you sure it isn't the Wild Hunt Aes Sedai?"
"But it is," Moraine replied. "It is."
"You can never outrun the Dark Hounds, blacksmith," Lan said. "Not on the fastest horse. Always you must face them and defeat them, or they will pull you down."
"I could have stayed in the steading, you know," Loyal said. "My mother would have had me married by now, but it would not have been a bad life. Plenty of books. I did not have to come outside."
"There," Moraine said, pointing to a tall, treeless mound well off to their right. There were no trees that Perrin could see for 200 paces or more around it either, and they were still sparse beyond that.
"We must see them coming to have a chance."
The Dark Hound's dire cries rose again, closer yet still far. Lan quickened Mondarb's pace a little, now that Moraine had chosen their ground. As they climbed, the horses' hooves clattered on rocks half buried in the dirt and slicked by the drizzle. To Perrin's eyes, most of them had too many squared corners to be natural. At the top, they dismounted around what seemed to be a low, rounded boulder. The moon appeared through a gap in the clouds, and he found himself looking at a weathered stone face 2 paces long. A woman's face, he thought from the length of the hair. The rainmaker seemed to be weeping. Moraine dismounted and stood looking off in the direction of the howls. She was a shadowed, hooded shape, rain-catching moonlight as it rolled down her oiled cloak. Loyal led his horse over to peer at the carving, then bent closer and felt the features.
"I think she was an Ogier," he said at last. "But this is not an old steading. I would feel it. We all would. And we would be safe from shadow spawn."
"What are you two staring at?"
Zareen squinted at the rock.
"What is it? Her? Who?"
"Many nations have risen and fallen since the breaking," Moraine said without turning. "Some leaving no more than names on a yellowed page or lines on a tattered map. Will we leave as much behind?"
The blood-drenched howls rose again, still closer. Perrin tried to calculate their pace and thought Lan had been right. The horses could not have outrun them after all. They would not have long to wait.
Ogier, Lan said, you and the girl hold the horses.
Zareen protested, but he rode straight over to her.
Your knives will not do much good here.
His sword blade gleamed in the moonlight as he drew it.
Even this is a last resort. It sounds like 10 out there, not one. Your work is to keep the horses from running when they smell the Darkhounds. Even Mondub does not like that smell.
If the warder's sword was no good, then neither was the axe. Perrin felt something near to relief at that, even if they were Shadowspawn. He would not have to use the axe. He drew the length of his unstrung bow from under Stepper's saddle girths.
Maybe this will do some good. Try if you wish, blacksmith, Lan said. They do not die easily. Perhaps you will kill one.
Perrin drew a fresh bowstring from his pouch, trying to shield it from the soft rain. The beeswax coating was thin and not much protection against prolonged damp. Setting the bow slantwise between his legs, he bent it easily, fixing the loops of the bowstring into the horn nocks at the ends of the bow. When he straightened, he could see the Darkhounds. They ran like horses at a gallop, and as he caught sight of them, they gathered speed. They were only 10 large shapes running in the night, sweeping through the scattered trees, yet he pulled a broadhead arrow from his quiver, knocked it, but did not draw. He had been far from the best bowman in Emmons Field, but among the younger men, only Rand had been better. At 300 paces, he would shoot, he decided.
Fool, you'd have a hard time hitting a target standing still at that distance. But if I wait, the way they are moving?
Stepping up beside Moraine, he raised his bow.
I just have to imagine that moving shadow was a big dog.
Drew the goose feather fletchings to his ear and loosed. He was sure the shaft merged with the nearest shadow, but the only result was a snarl.
It is not going to work. They're coming too fast.
He was already drawing another arrow.
Why aren't you doing something, Moraine?
He could see their eyes, shining like silver, their teeth gleaming like burnished steel. Black as the night itself and as big as small ponies, they sped toward him, silent now, seeking the kill. The wind carried a stink near to burned sulfur. The horses whickered fearfully, even Lan's warhorse.
Burn you, Aes Sedai, do something!
He loosed again. The frontmost Darkhound faltered and came on.
They can die.
He shot once more, and the lead Darkhound tumbled, staggered to its feet, then fell. Yet even as it did, he knew a moment of despair. One down, and the other 9 had covered 2/3 of the distance already. They seemed to be running even faster, like shadows flowing across the ground.
One more arrow. Time for one more, maybe. And then it's the axe. Burn you, Aes Sedai!
He drew again.
Now,
Moraine said as his arrow left the bow. The air between her hands caught fire and streaked toward the Darkhound's vanquishing knight. The horses squealed and leaped against being held. Perrin threw an arm across his eyes to shield them from a white-hot glare, like burning, heat like a forge cracking open. Sudden noon flared in the darkness and was gone. When he uncovered his eyes, spots flickered across his vision and the faint, fading image of that line of fire. Where the Darkhounds had been was nothing but night-covered ground and the soft rain. The only shadows that moved were cast by clouds crossing the moon.
I thought she'd throw fire at them or call lightning, but this...
What was that? He asked hoarsely.
Moraine was peering off toward Ilion again, as if she could see through all those miles of darkness.
Perhaps he did not see, she said, almost to herself. It is far, and if he was not watching, perhaps he did not notice.
Who? Zareen demanded.
Samael?
Her voice shook a little.
You said he was in Ilion. How could he see anything here? What did you do?
Something forbidden, Moraine said coolly. Forbidden by vows almost as strong as the 3 oaths. She took Aldeeb's reins from the girl and patted the mare's neck, calming her.
Something not used in nearly 2,000 years. Something I might be stilled just for knowing.
Perhaps,
Loyal's voice was a faint boom,
Perhaps we should be going. There could be more.
I think not, the Aes Sedai said, mounting. He would not loose two packs at once, even if he has two. They would turn on each other instead of their prey. And I think we are not his main quarry, or he would have come himself. We were an annoyance, I think.
Her tone was calm, but it was clear she did not like being regarded so lightly.
And perhaps a little something extra to slip into his game bag, if we were not too much trouble. Still, there is small good in remaining any nearer him than we must.
Rand? Perrin asked. He could almost feel Zareen leaning forward to listen. If we are not what he hunts, is it Rand?
Perhaps, Moraine said, or perhaps Matt. Remember that he is Tavirin also, and he blew the horn of Valyr.
Zareen made a strangled sound.
He blew it? Someone has found it already?
The Aes Sedai ignored her, leaning out of her saddle to stare closely into Perrin's eyes, dark gleaming into burnished gold.
Once again, events outpace me. I do not like that. And neither should you. If events outrun me, they may well trample you and the rest of the world with you.
We have many leagues to Tyr yet, Lan said. The Ogier's suggestion is a good one. He was already in his saddle.
After a moment, Moraine straightened and touched the mare's ribs with her heels. She was halfway down the side of the mound before he could get his bow unstrung and take Stepper's reins from Loyal.
Burn you, Moraine. I'll find some answers somewhere.
Leaning back against a fallen log, Matt enjoyed the warmth of the campfire. The rains had drifted south 3 days earlier, but he still felt damp. Yet right at that moment, he was hardly aware of the dancing flames. He peered thoughtfully at the small, wax-covered cylinder in his hand. Tom was engrossed in tuning his harp, muttering to himself of rain and wet, never glancing Matt's way. Crickets chirped in the dark thicket around them. Caught between villages by sunset, they had chosen this copse away from the road. Two nights they had tried to buy a room for the night. Twice a farmer had loosed his dogs on them. Matt unsheathed his belt knife and hesitated.
Luck. It only explodes sometimes, she said. Luck.
As carefully as he could, he slid along the length of the tube. It was a tube, and of paper as he had thought. He found bits of paper on the ground after fireworks were set off back home. Layers of paper, but all that filled the inside was something that looked like dirt or maybe tiny gray-black pebbles and dust. He stirred them on his palm with one finger.
How in the light could pebbles explode?
The light burned me, Tom roared.
He thrust his harp into its case as if to protect it from what was in Matt's hand.
Are you trying to kill us, boy? Haven't you heard those things explode 10 times as hard for air as for fire? Fireworks are the next thing to Aes Sedai work, boy.
Maybe, Matt said. But Aludra did not look like any Aes Sedai to me. I used to think that about Master Alvir's clock, that it had to be Aes Sedai work. But once I got the back of the cabinet open, I saw it was full of little pieces of metal.
He shifted uncomfortably at the memory. Mistress Alvir had been the first to reach him that time, with the wisdom and his father and the mayor all right behind her, and none believing he just meant to look.
I could have put them all back together.
I think Perrin could make one, if he saw those little wheels and springs, and I don't know what all.
You would be surprised, boy, Tom said dryly. Even a bad clockmaker is a fairly rich man, and they earn it. But a clock does not explode in your face.
Neither did this. Well, it is useless now.
He tossed the handful of paper and little pebbles into the fire to a screech from Tom. The pebbles sparkled and made tiny flashes, and there was a smell of acrid smoke.
You are trying to kill us.
Tom's voice was unsteady, and it rose in intensity and pitch as he spoke.
If I decide I want to die, I will go to the royal palace when we reach Caimlin, and I'll pinch more gaze.
His long mustaches flailed.
Do not do that again.
It did not explode, Matt said, frowning at the fire. He fished into the oiled cloth roll on the other side of the log and pulled out a firework of the next larger size.
I wonder why there was no bang.
I do not care why there was no bang. Do not do it again!
Matt glanced at him and laughed. Stop shaking, Tom. There's no need to be afraid. I know what is inside them now. At least, I know what it looks like, but... Don't say it. I will not be cutting any more open, Tom. It is more fun to set them off, anyway.
I am not afraid, you mud-footed swineherd, Tom said with elaborate dignity. I am shaking with rage because I'm traveling with a goat-brained lout who might kill the pair of us because he cannot think past his own.
Ho! The fire!
Matt exchanged glances with Tom as horses' hooves approached. It was late for anyone honest to be traveling, but the Queen's guards kept the roads safe this close to Camelin, and the four who rode into the firelight certainly did not look like robbers. One was a woman. The men all wore long cloaks and seemed to be her retainers, while she was pretty and blue-eyed in gold necklace and a gray silk dress and a velvet cloak with a wide hood. The men dismounted. One held her reins and another her stirrup, and she smiled at Matt, doffing her gloves as she came near the fire.
"I fear we are caught out late, young master," she said, "and I would trouble you for directions to an inn if you know one."
He grinned and started to rise. He had made it as far as a crouch when he heard one of the men mutter something and another produced a crossbow from under his cloak, already drawn with a clip holding the bolt.
"Kill him, fool!"
the woman shouted, and Matt tossed the firework into the flames and threw himself toward his quarterstaff. There was a loud bang and a flash of light.
"Aye, said aye!"
a man cried.
"Fireworks, fool!"
the woman shouted. And he rolled to his feet with the staff in his hand to see the crossbow bolt sticking out of the fallen log almost where he had been sitting, and the crossbowman falling with the hilt of one of Tom's knives adorning his chest. It was all he had time to see, for the other two men darted past the fire at him, drawing swords. One of them suddenly stumbled to his knees, dropping his sword to claw at a knife in his back as he fell face down. The last man did not see his companion fall. He obviously expected to be one of a pair, dividing their opponent's attention as he thrust his blade at Matt's middle. Feeling almost contemptuous, Matt cracked the fellow's wrist with one end of his staff, sending the sword flying, and cracked his forehead with the other. The man's eyes rolled up in his head as he collapsed. From the corner of his eye, Matt saw the woman walking toward him, and he stuck a finger at her like a knife.
"Fine clothes you wear for a thief, woman. You sit down till I decide what to do with you, or I'll..."
She looked as surprised as Matt at the knife that suddenly bloomed in her throat, a red flower of spreading blood. He took a half step as if to catch her as she fell, knowing it was no good. Her long cloak settled over her, covering everything but her face and the hilt of Tom's knife.
"Burn you," Matt muttered. "Burn you, Tom Marilyn, a woman? Light, we could have tied her up and given her to the Queen's guards tomorrow in Camelin. Light, I might even have let her go. She'd rob nobody without these three, and the only one that lives will be days before he can see straight and months before he can hold a sword. Burn you, Tom, there was no need to kill her."
The gleeman limped to where the woman lay and kicked back her cloak. The dagger had half fallen from her hand, its blade as wide as Matt's thumb, and two hands long.
"Would you rather I had waited till she nested that in your ribs, boy?"
He retrieved his own knife, wiping the blade on her cloak. Matt realized he was humming "She Wore a Mask That Hid Her Face" and stopped it. He bent down and hid hers with the hood of her cloak.
"Best we move on," he said quietly. "I do not want to have to explain this if a patrol of the guards happens by."
"With her in those clothes," Tom said, "I should say not. They must have robbed a merchant's wife or some noblewoman's carriage."
His voice became gentler. "If we're going, boy, you had best see to saddling your horse." Matt gave a start and pulled his eyes from the dead woman.
"Yes, I had better, hadn't I?"
He didn't look at her again. He had no such compunction about the men. As far as he was concerned, a man who decided to rob and kill deserved what he got when he lost the game. He did not dwell on them, but neither did he jerk his eyes away if they fell on one of the robbers.
It was after he had saddled his gelding and tied his things on behind while he was kicking dirt onto the fire that he found himself looking at the man who had shot the crossbow. There was something familiar about those features, about the way the smothering fire made shadows across them. Luck, he told himself. Always the luck. The crossbowman was a good swimmer, Tom, he said as he climbed into the saddle.
What foolery are you talking now?
The gleeman was on his horse, too, and far more concerned with how his instrument cases rode behind his saddle than he was with the dead.
How could you know whether he could swim at all?
He made it ashore from a small boat in the middle of the Aranin in the middle of the night. I guess that used up all his luck. He checked the lashings on the roll of fireworks again. If that fool thought one of these was Aes Sedai, I wonder what he'd have thought if they all went off.
Are you sure, boy? The chances of it being the same man. Why, even you wouldn't lay a wager against those odds.
I am sure, Tom. Elaine, I will wring your neck when I put my hands on you. And Egwene's and Nynaeve's, too. And I am sure I intend to have this bloody letter out of my hands an hour after we reach Camelin.
I tell you, there is nothing in that letter, boy. I played Deus Demar when I was younger than you, and I can recognize a code or a cipher even when I don't know what it says.
Well, I never played your great game, Tom, your bloody game of houses, but I know when someone is chasing me, and they'd not be chasing me this hard or this far for the gold in my pockets. Not for less than a chest full of gold. It has to be the letter. Burn me, pretty girls always get me in trouble. Do you feel like sleeping tonight after this?
With the sleep of an innocent babe, boy. But if you want to ride, I'll ride.
The face of a pretty woman floated into Matt's head with a dagger in her throat. You had no luck, pretty woman.
Then let's ride, he said savagely.
Chapter 45. Camelin. Matt had vague memories of Camelin, but when they approached it in the early hours after sunrise, it seemed as if he had never been there before. They had not been alone on the road since first light, and other riders surrounded them now, and trains of merchants' wagons and folk afoot, all streaming toward the great city. Built on rising hills, it was surely as large as Tarvalen, and outside the huge walls, a 50-foot height of pale grayish stone, streaked with white and silver sparkling in the sun, spaced with tall round towers with the lion banner of Andor waving atop them, white on red. Outside those walls, it seemed as if another great city had been placed, wrapping around the walled city, all red brick and gray stone and white plastered walls, inns pushed in on houses of 3 and 4 stories so fine they must belong to wealthy merchants, shops with goods displayed on tables under awnings crowding against wide windowless warehouses. Open markets under red and purple roof tiles lined the road on both sides, men and women already crying their wares, bargaining at the top of their voices. While penned calves and sheep and goats and pigs, caged geese and chickens and ducks added to the din. He seemed to remember thinking Camelin was too noisy when he was here before. Now it seemed like a heartbeat, pumping wealth. The road led to arched gates 20 feet high, standing open under the watchful eye of red-coated Queen's guards in their shining breastplates. They eyed Tom and him no more than anyone else. Not even the quarterstaff slanted across his saddle in front of him. All they cared was that people keep moving, it seemed. And then they were within. Slender towers here rose even taller than those along the walls, and gleaming domes shone white and gold above streets teeming with people. Just inside the gates, the road split into 2 parallel streets, separated by a wide strip of grass and trees. The hills of the city rose like steps toward a peak, which was surrounded by another wall, shining as white as Tarvalen's, with still more domes and towers within. That was the inner city, Matt recalled, and atop those highest hills stood the royal palace. No point waiting, he told Tom. I'll take the letter straight on. He looked at the sedan chairs and carriages making their way through the crowds, the shops with all their goods displayed. A man could earn some gold in this city, Tom, once he found a game of dice or cards. He was not quite so lucky at cards as at dice,
but few except nobles and the wealthy played those games anyway.
Now that's who I should find a game with.
Tom yawned at him and hitched at his gleeman's cloak as if it were a blanket.
We have ridden all night, boy. Let's at least find something to eat first. The Queen's blessing has good meals.
He yawned again.
And good beds.
I remember that, Matt said slowly.
He did, in a way. The innkeeper was a fat man with graying hair, Master Gill. Moraine had caught up to Rand and him there, when he had thought they were finally free of her.
She's off playing her game with Rand now. Nothing to do with me, not anymore.
I will meet you there, Tom. I said I'd have this letter out of my hands an hour after I arrived, and I mean to. You go on.
Tom nodded and turned his horse aside, calling over his shoulder through a yawn.
Do not become lost, boy. It's a big city, Camelin.
And a rich one. Matt heeled his mount on up the crowded street.
Lost? I can find my bloody way.
The sickness appeared to have erased parts of his memory. He could look at an inn, its upper floors sticking out over the ground floor all the way around, and its sign creaking in the breeze, and remember seeing it before, yet not recall another thing he could see from that spot. 100 paces of street might abruptly spark in his memory, while the parts before and after remained as mysterious as dice still in the cup. Even with the holes in his memory, he was sure he had never been to the inner city or the royal palace. I couldn't forget that. Yet he did not need to remember the way. The streets of the new city, he remembered that name suddenly, it was the part of Camelin less than 2,000 years old, ran every which way, but the main boulevards all led to the inner city. The guards at the gates made no effort to stop anyone. Within those white walls were buildings that could have almost fit in Tarvalin. The curving streets topped hills to reveal thin towers, their tiled walls sparkling with 100 colors in the sunlight, or to look down on parks laid out in patterns made to be viewed from above, or to show sweeping vistas across the entire city to the rolling plains and forests beyond. It did not really matter which streets he took. They all spiraled in on what he sought, the royal palace of Andor. In no time he found himself crossing the huge oval plaza before the palace, riding toward its tall, gilded gates. The pure white palace of Andor would certainly not have been out of place among Tarvalin's wonders, with its slender towers and golden domes shining in the sun, its high balconies and intricate stonework. The gold leaf on one of those domes could have kept him in luxury for a year. There were fewer people in the plaza than elsewhere, as if it were reserved for great occasions. 12 of the guards stood before the closed gates, bows slanted, all at exactly the same angle, across their gleaming breastplates, faces hidden by the steel bars of their burnished helmets' face guards. A heavy-set officer, with his red cloak thrown back to reveal a knot of gold braid on his shoulder, was walking up and down the line, eyeing each man as if he thought he might find rust or dust. Matt drew rein and put on a smile.
"Good morning to you, Captain."
The officer turned, staring at him through the bars of his face guard with deep, beady eyes like a pudgy rat in a cage. The man was older than he had expected, surely old enough to have more than one knot of rank, and fat rather than stocky.
"What do you want, farmer?" he demanded roughly.
Matt drew a breath. "Make it good. Impress this fool so he doesn't keep me waiting all day. I don't want to have to flash the Armorlin's paper around to keep from kicking my heels."
"I come from Tarvalin, from the White Tower, bearing a letter from—"
"You come from Tarvalin, farmer?"
The fat officer's stomach shook as he laughed, but then his laughter cut off as if severed with a knife, and he glared.
"We want no letters from Tarvalin, rogue, if you have such a thing. Our good queen, may the light illumine her, will take no word from the White Tower until the daughter heir is returned to her. I never heard of any messenger from the tower wearing a countryman's coat and breeches. It is plain to me you are up to some trick, perhaps thinking you'll find a few coins if you come claiming to carry letters. But you'll be lucky if you don't end in a prison cell. If you do come from Tarvalin, go back and tell the tower to return the daughter heir before we come and take her. If you're a trickster after silver, get out of my sight before I have you beaten within an inch of your life. Either way, you half-wit looby, be gone."
Matt had been trying to edge a word in from the beginning of the man's speech. He said quickly,
The letter is from her, man. It's from...
Did I not tell you to be gone, ruffian?
The fat man bellowed. His face was growing nearly as red as his coat.
Take yourself out of my sight, you gutter scum! If you are not gone by the time I count 10, I will arrest you for littering the plaza with your presence. 1, 2.
Can you count so high, you fat fool? Matt snapped. I tell you, Elaine sent...
Guards!
The officer's face was purple now.
Seize this man for a dark friend!
Matt hesitated a moment. Sure, no one could take such a charge seriously, but the red-coated guards dashed toward him, all dozen men in breastplates and helmets, and he wheeled his horse and galloped ahead of them, followed by the fat man's shouts. The gelding was no racer, but it outdistanced men afoot easily enough. People dodged out of his way along the curving streets, shaking fists after him and shouting as many curses as the officer had.
Fool, he thought, meaning the fat officer, then added another for himself. All I had to do was say her bloody name in the beginning. Elaine, the daughter heir of Andor, sends this letter to her mother, Queen Morghese. Light, who could have thought they'd think that way about Tarvalin?
From what he remembered of his last visit, Aes Sedai in the White Tower had been close behind Queen Morghese in the guard's affections.
Burn her. Elaine could have told me.
Reluctantly, he added, I could have asked questions, too. Before he reached the arched gates that led out into the new city, he slowed to a walk. He did not think the guards from the palace could still be chasing him, and there was no point in attracting the eyes of those at the gate by galloping through, but they looked at him no more now than when he had first entered. As he rode under the broad arch, he smiled and almost turned back. He had suddenly remembered something and had an idea that appealed to him a good deal more than walking through the palace gates. Even if that fat officer had not been watching the gates, he thought he would like it better. He became lost twice while searching for the queen's blessing, but at last he found the sign with a man kneeling before a woman with red-gold hair and a crown of golden roses, her hand on his head. It was a broad stone building of 3 stories, with tall windows even up under the red roof tiles. He rode around back to the stable yard, where a horse-faced fellow in a leather vest that could hardly be any tougher than his skin took his horse's reins. He thought he remembered the fellow. Yes, Raimi. It has been a long time, Raimi. Matt tossed him a silver mark. You remember me, don't you?
Can't say as I...
Raimi began, then caught the shine of the silver where he had expected copper. He coughed, and his short nod turned into something that combined a knuckled forehead with a jerky bow.
Why, of course I do, young master. Forgive me, slip my mind. Mind no good for people, good for horses. I know horses, I do. A fine animal, young master. I'll take good care of him, you can be sure.
He delivered it all quickly, with no room for Matt to say a word, then hurried the gelding into the stable before he might have to come up with Matt's name. With a sour grimace, Matt put the fat roll of fireworks under his arm and shouldered the rest of his belongings. Fellow couldn't tell me from Hawkwing's toenails. A bulky, muscular fellow was sitting on an upturned barrel beside the door to the kitchen, gently scratching the ear of a black-and-white cat crouched on his knee. The man studied Matt with heavy-lidded eyes, especially the quarterstaff across his shoulder. But he never stopped his scratching. Matt thought he remembered him, but he could not bring up a name. He said nothing as he went through the door, and neither did the man. No reason they should remember me. Probably have bloody Aes Sedai coming for people every day. In the kitchen, 2 undercooks and 3 scullions were darting between stoves and roasting spits under the direction of a round woman with her hair in a bun and a long wooden spoon that she used to point out what she wanted done. Matt was sure he remembered the round woman. Colleen, and what a name for a woman that wide. But everybody called her Cook.
Well, Cook, he announced, I am back, and not a year since left. She peered at him a moment, then nodded.
I remember you.
He began to grin.
You were with that young prince, weren't you?
She went on.
The one who looked so like Tigraine. The light illumined her memory. You're a serving man, aren't you? Is he coming back, then, the young prince?
No, he said curtly. A prince? Light. I do not think he will be any time soon, and I don't think you would like it if he did. She protested, saying what a fine, handsome young man the prince was.
Burn me, is there a woman anywhere who doesn't moon over Rand and make calf eyes if you mention his bloody name?
She'd bloody scream if she'd knew what he is doing now. but he refused to let her get it out. "Is Master Gill about, and Tom Marilyn?"
"In the library," she said with a tight sniff.
"You tell Basil Gill when you see him that I said those drains need cleaning. Today, mind." She caught sight of something one of the undercooks was doing to a beef roast and waddled over to her. "Not so much, child. You'll make the meat too sweet if you put so much arith on it." She seemed to have forgotten Matt already. He shook his head as he went in search of this library he could not remember. He could not remember that Colleen was married to Master Gill either, but if he had ever heard a good wife send instructions to her husband, that had been it. A pretty serving girl with big eyes giggled and directed him down a hall beside the common room. When he stepped into the library, he stopped and stared. There had to be more than 300 books on the shelves built on the walls, and more lying on the tables. He had never seen so many books in one place in his life. He noticed a leather-bound copy of The Travels of Jane Farstrider on a table near the door. He'd always meant to read that. Rand and Perrin had always been telling him things out of it. But he never did seem to get around to reading the books he meant to read. Pink-faced Basil Gill and Tom Marilyn were seated at one of the tables, facing each other across a stones board, pipes in their teeth, trailing thin blue streamers of tobacco smoke. A calico cat sat on the table beside a wooden dice cup, her tail curled over her feet, watching them play. The gleeman's cloak was nowhere in sight, so Matt supposed he had already gotten a room.
"You're done sooner than I expected, boy," Tom said around his pipe stem. He tugged one long white mustache as he considered where to place his next stone on the board's crosshatchings. "Basil, you remember Matt Cawthon?"
"I remember," the fat innkeeper said, peering at the board. "Sickly the last time you were here, I recall. I hope you are better now, lad."
"I am better," Matt said. "Is that all you remember, that I was sick?"
Master Gill winced at Tom's move and took his pipe out of his mouth. "Considering who you left with, lad, and considering the way things are now, maybe it's best I remember no more than that."
"Aes Sedai, not in such good odor now, are they?" Matt set his things in one big armchair, the quarterstaff propped against the back, and himself in another with one leg swinging over the arm. "The guards at the palace seemed to think the White Tower had stolen Elaine." Tom eyed the roll of fireworks uneasily, looked at his smoking pipe, and muttered to himself before going back to his study of the board.
"Hardly that," Gil said, "but the whole city knows she disappeared from the tower. Tom says she's returned, but we've heard none of that here. Perhaps Morgaze knows, but everyone down to a stable boy is stepping lightly so she doesn't snap off his head. Lord Gabriel has kept her from actually sending anyone to the headsman, but I'd not say she would not do it. And he has certainly not soothed her temper toward Tarvalin. If anything, I think he has made it worse."
"Morgaze has a new advisor," Tom said in a dry voice. "Gareth Bryn did not like him, so Bryn has been retired to his estate to watch his sheep grow wool. Basil, are you going to place a stone or not?"
"In a moment, Tom. In a moment. I want to set it right."
Gil clamped his teeth around his pipe stem and frowned at the board, puffing up smoke. "So the queen has an advisor who doesn't like Tarvalin," Matt said. "Well, that explains the way the guards acted when I said I came from there."
"If you told them that," Gil said, "you might be lucky you escaped without any broken bones. If it was any of the new men, at least. Gabriel has replaced half the guards in Canaan with men of his choosing, and that is no mean feat considering how short a time he has been here. Some say Morgaze may marry him."
He started to put a stone on the board, then took it back with a shake of his head.
"Times change, people change. Too much change for me. I suppose I'm growing old."
"You seem to mean us both to grow old before you place a stone," Tom muttered.
The cat stretched and slinked across the table for him to stroke her back.
"Talking all day will not let you find a good move. Why don't you just admit defeat, Basil?"
"I never admit defeat," Gil said stoutly. "I'll beat you yet, Tom."
He set a white stone on the intersection of two lines.
"You will see."
Tom snorted. From what Matt could see of the board, he did not think Gil had much chance. I will just have to avoid the guards and put Elaine's letter right into Morgaze's hands. Especially if they're all like that fat fool. Light, I wonder if he's told them all I'm a dark friend.
You did not deliver it, Tom barked. I thought you were anxious to be rid of the thing.
You have a letter from the daughter heir? Gil exclaimed. Tom, why did you not tell me?
I'm sorry, Basil, the gleeman muttered. He glared at Matt from under those bushy eyebrows and blew out his mustaches. The boy thinks someone is out to kill him over it, so I thought I'd let him say what he wanted and no more. Seems he does not care any longer.
What kind of letter? Gil asked. Is she coming home? And Lord Gawain? I hope they are. I've actually heard talk of war with Tarvalin, as if anyone could be fool enough to go to war with Aes Sedai. If you ask me, it is all one with those mad rumors we've heard about Aes Sedai supporting a false dragon somewhere in the west and using the power as a weapon. Not that I can see why that would make anyone want to go to war with them. Just the opposite.
Are you married to Colleen? Matt asked, and Master Gil gave a start.
The light preserved me from that. You would think the inn was hers now, if she was my wife. What does that have to do with the daughter heir's letter?
Nothing, Matt said. But you went on so long, I thought you must have forgotten your own questions.
Gil made a choking sound, and Tom barked a laugh. Matt hurried on before the innkeeper could speak.
The letter is sealed. Elaine did not tell me what it says.
Tom was eyeing him sideways and stroking his mustaches.
Does he think I'll admit we opened the thing? But I don't think she is coming home. She means to be Aes Sedai, if you ask me.
He told them about his attempt to deliver the letter, smoothing over a few edges they had no need to know about.
The new men, Gil said. That officer sounds it, at least. I'll wager on it. No better than brigands, most of them, except the ones with a sly eye. You wait until this afternoon, lad, when the guards in the gate will have changed. Say the daughter heir's name right out, and just in case the new fellow is one of Gabriel's men, too, duck your head a little. A knuckle to your forehead, and you'll have no trouble.
Burn me if I will. I will pull wool and scratch gravel for nobody. Not to Morgaze herself. This time I'll not go near the guards at all.
I would just as soon not know what word that fat fellow has spread. They stared at him as if he were mad.
How, under the light, Gil said, do you mean to enter the royal palace without passing the guards?
His eyes widened as if he were remembering something.
Light, you don't mean to... Lad, you'd need the Dark One's own luck to escape with your life.
What are you going on about now, Basil? Matt, what fool thing do you intend to try?
I am lucky, Master Gil, Matt said. You just have a good meal waiting when I come back.
As he stood, he picked up the dice cup and spun the dice out beside the stones board for luck. The calico cat leaped down, hissing at him with her back arched. The five spotted dice came to rest, each showing a single pip. The Dark One's eyes.
That's the best toss or the worst, Gil said. It depends on the game you are playing, doesn't it? Lad, I think you mean to play a dangerous game. Why don't you take that cup out into the common room and lose a few coppers? You look to me like a fellow who might like a little gamble. I will see the letter gets to the palace safely.
Colleen wants you to clean the drains, Matt told him, and turned to Tom while the innkeeper was still blinking and muttering to himself. It doesn't seem to make any odds whether I get an arrow in me trying to deliver that letter or a knife in my back waiting. It's six up and half a dozen down. Just you have that meal waiting, Tom.
He tossed a gold mark on the table in front of Gil.
Have my things put in a room, innkeeper. If it takes more coin, you will have it. Be careful of the big roll. It frightens Tom something awful.
As he stalked out, he heard Gil say to Tom,
I have always thought that lad was a rascal. How does he come by gold?
I always win, that's how, he thought grimly. I just have to win once more, and I'm done with Elaine. And that's the last of the White Tower for me. Just once more.
Chapter 46. A Message Out of the Shadow. Even as he returned to the inner city on foot, Matt was far from certain that what he intended would actually work. It would, if what he had been told was true.
but it was the truth of that he was not sure of. He avoided the oval plaza in front of the palace, but wandered around the sides of the huge structure and its grounds, along streets that curved